From an early age, we're all immersed in sport. For some, it fails to ignite a spark inside us, but for those of us who catch the fire, it's the beginning of a lifelong journey filled with highs and lows, which all matter far more than they should. After all, it's just a game, we're told. Sport is a certainty, it's a point of reference in an increasingly uncertain world, and the bonds formed with either sport in general or a hometown club transcend both time and generations. Today, much of what sport has always meant to true fans has been somehow lost in a blizzard of corporate communications, fireworks, and froth. The attachments that were once so strong seem more trivial in the global age of televised sport as entertainment. What was once authentic has become increasingly staged. In this podcast, we'll get back to the things that sport has always meant to true fans. We'll take you from the boardroom, to the dressing room, to the pitch, but we'll do it not as a corporate communication, but as true fans of sport, and we'll do it with authenticity. We'll be honest, and we'll speak our minds. This is a podcast for true sports fans, and the one thing all fans have in common is a passion for the game. Now, we certainly don't mean to cause any offence, so if you find yourself taking any, just shrug it off and get back in the game, because this is about the game, and the game is bigger than all of us. Well, welcome everybody to Are You Not Entertained? We're back for season two. It's been a long summer and there's so much to talk about, and we're going to get into that right away. But first, joining me as always is my friend Roger Mitchell. Roger, g'day.
G'day. How are you, Grant?
I'm good. Where now? Where are you, first of all? Let's get that sorted out.
Well, I'm in Como, and I believe you've come towards me, as in the lake, and you've come towards me today.
I am. We're in the same country at the very least to start this season off. So that's a little bit better proximity than we had most of the time in season one. But listen, Rog, it has been a great summer, and we'll get into that shortly, because there's so much to talk about. But first, I think we should just talk about season two, what we're going to try and do, and why we're going to do it all again. What do you think?
Yeah, you know, we had a thought at the end of the last season whether we wanted to continue, because there's so many good podcasts out there, and you know, I thought that it was important for us to try and to be doing something different, and we thought about it, and we came up with the fact that, you know, in our view, this whole sector, this whole area is going to probably be decided in the next 5 years, 6 years or so, and if there is a time to have an opinion, it's probably now. And I think we do cover in a different way the industry, not just from the business side, but from, you know, we can look at it from fans' perspective as well. And I think that's why we decided to continue. A lot of people asked us to come back, and that was important as well, mate.
Well, I think you're right. I mean, as you said, that was our view, but we also had plenty of listeners chipping in. And you know, and I would say to everybody listening to this and who are back with us from season one, or maybe just joining us for season two, please do spread the word and share links to the podcast. Get it up on Twitter, because the bigger audience we can build, the better this is going to be, and the more chance people are going to have to air their views and talk about things that, you know, we all know shouldn't matter to us quite as much as they do, but God knows they do matter to us, and it's
ever more so.
Great. Yeah, ever more so, because a lot of the things that are happening now is this kind of unholy alliance between true fandom and big business shows signs of really being disruptive in the best and worst ways possible. Let's everybody get your opinions out there, get them heard, and get people understanding what the fans think, and let's hopefully try and help the fans understand the way big business looks at this.
Yeah, and I think we want to certainly get away from all the kind of like media trained, kind of like bland discussion that so much of sport has to be about these days, to avoid the world that we live in of not making a mistake and everything like that. I think one of our differentiators is we want to try and risk a little bit. If we have to decide what side of the PC border we should be on, we'll probably get that wrong on the wrong side. But, you know, I think it's important that, you know, we've got an opinion that we can back up and is balanced.
Well, look, Roger, if there's a border, I know you're always going to be north of it, because that's where you come from. So that's a good thing. That's a good thing. And fortunately, we don't have any media training, so they've got us whether they like us or not. So look, let's get into the summer, Roger, because what a summer it's been. I mean, I almost don't know where to start. I know where I'm going to start, but it was a tough call. But what a fantastic couple of months we've had in the sporting world.
I will let you start, but in terms of the macro summary, I would say that I think we've seen a lot of things that have been quite dramatic and good and bad over the summer months that will inform a lot of the direction going forward, both on and off the fields. So why don't you kick us off with what's foremost in your mind, Grant?
Well, I feel bad about this because I feel like I'm stealing this from you, but it has been a thing, amazingly for me, that's really caught my attention this summer, and that's the cricket. You know, you're a much bigger cricket fan than I am. Yeah. I have a passing interest in cricket. I watched it, you know, the Botham years as a kid, watched the test matches. I didn't play. I played it a few times and just got bored. But I've got to say that you know, that World Cup was truly, truly extraordinary. And to see what Ben Stokes did in the World Cup, and then to follow it up in the test match, two just fabulous stories of in the first case, true sporting drama, and in the second case, an heroic one-man performance to single-handedly win a test match for England and keep a series alive. I mean, it was Roy the Rover stuff from Ben Stokes in the test match, and it was, I mean, a confluence of events that, as I said, for non-cricket fans, you couldn't possibly understand just how dramatic that World Cup final was. But the beauty of it was that even non-cricket fans, I think, really got into the drama and saw it for what it was, a thrilling contest.
Yeah, I think it was very unfortunate that it was on the same day as the final of Wimbledon.
Yeah, absolutely.
That aside, everybody obviously caught up later on. And you're right. You know, I'm a great fan of cricket. If there's people out there, and I know that these days sports documentaries are the big thing, have a look. And you too, Grant, have a look at a documentary called Fire in Babylon, which is about the beginning of the West Indies pace attack team led by Clive Lloyd and coming to England and, you know, battering them in every single way and the bruising of Brian Close. It is a wonderful, wonderful documentary. And I'm pleased for cricket because, as I say, I'm a fan. I've always been a fan. And it kind of like went into the doldrums for many, many years. Many people would say that's because it went on behind a paywall on pay TV and it lost its free to air. Many people will say it's because the formatting was all wrong. County cricket, I think, is a real challenge. And test cricket over 5 days is not what the modern sports world wants. So cricket, I think, has to be given a lot of kudos because it introduced 2020. It's now introducing the 100. It's got vibrant new leaders. And of course, the great thing it's got is that it is so, so popular in Southeast Asia, where the demographics are absolutely what every sport is looking for now. Young, passionate, big numbers. So the future for cricket, I think, is very, very bright. I'm not sure we'll see those kind of incidents that we saw within the space of 2 weeks every day, but it was a great way to start the summer, and so many people that love the game the way I do were just blown away. Just fantastic.
But I think it's important that you know what you say there about you don't think we're going to see that every day, and that's as you and I both know, that's absolutely fine, right? You don't expect to see it every day. That's what makes it so memorable, is when you see these once in a lifetime performances happen from the same guy twice in 2 weeks, as you say. It is remarkable. But you know, I was thinking as I was watching the cricket what you said there, and going back to season one when we talked about golf, and I'm sure we're going to come on to golf at some point because we've had plenty of that going on in the summer as well. You know, and you talked about the time taken to play games and you know, the fact that the modern audience doesn't want 4 hour rounds of golf and that golf was going to have to change. And I kind of pushed back on you a little bit there. But I have to say, you know, watching the cricket and I say some of the things that were happening in golf over the summer, which we'll get onto, have me kind of moving towards you a little bit. I hate to say it, and I'm not all the way there yet, but it certainly got me thinking. But the other part of the cricket that I really think is important to point out, particularly, and I'm talking about the World Cup final now, not the Test match, but the Kiwi captain, the Kiwi team. I mean, you want to talk about sportsmanship. You want to talk about, you know, good character in the face of adversity. And as it turned out, you know, they should have won the game, right? They should have won the game. Throw from the boundary.
Hitting the bat.
They should have won, right? Should have won, because when that throw was made, the runners hadn't crossed. And, you know, to see the captain stand up there at the end of what was a thrilling performance for the neutral, but a heartbreaking loss for the Kiwis, who, you know, have never won the World Cup, the Cricket World Cup, to see his composure and the way he handled it all, I mean, it was everything sport was about. You know, that one day of competition was everything that was good about sport, I thought.
Yeah, I'm not sure I would have taken it as well as that. And our common friend and obviously great New Zealand cricketer, Chris Cairns, himself, was just as magnanimous. And I don't know how they do that, because you kind of know they're not...
Because they're not Scotsmen, Rog. It's perfectly simple. They're Kiwis and they're all very nice. And you're a Scotsman and you're not. No, it's that simple.
maybe. But, you know, I think it's one of those things. It reminded me a little bit of, you know, forgive me, a lot of people won't remember this, but the time that Sampdoria got to the final of the European Cup against Cruyff Barcelona. And, you know, it was the time when only the champions get into the Champions League. And, you know, they won the Serie A the year before. They got to the final. Viale Mancini against Barcelona, and they lost it right at the end. And, you know, Mancini crying at the end, because he knew that would never, ever happen again. And you know, I kind of get a sense of that with it, with this New Zealand. And that's why to take it so well was just fantastic for them. Great for their sport. As I said, I think it's one of the sports I'm really bullish about. And there's some great young leaders in the governing bodies of cricket. And, you know, hopefully they can push on from here.
Well, it's certainly, as you said, got a lot of tailwinds behind it, cricket at the moment. And so, you know, it is up to the powers that be to take advantage of that, harness them and drive the game in the direction it needs to go.
And a lot of people will say, well, you know, it was on free to air and that makes a huge difference. And cricket got into the doldrums because it took the money and went to a much restricted audience and everybody forgot about BBC test coverage and everything like that. This is the old conundrum that we will come on to many, many times in this season. You know, what does a sport do? Does it take the easy money from pay TV? Will that even be available for second and third tier rights? Or do they try and market their sport against, you know, more and more sceptical and diffident type kids that are not interested, and they go free to air and they go for the exposure? It's one of the hardest trade-offs in sport, has been for the last 3 or 4 years, and it will definitely be in the next 5.
I think you're absolutely right. We'll see, and I think it gives us kind of an all-star we can follow to see the kind of decisions they make in cricket, because I'm sure other sports will be watching them.
Yeah. Oh, by the way, you know, I just don't want to let this go before saying, you know that New Zealand, if you look at the result community adjusted, they actually won.
Yeah, you know what? There's a lot of people that won't have a clue what you're talking about now, and I'm glad about that. But if they want to look, just look up community adjusted and you'll find out what Roger's baiting me with. Well, look, Roger, we will get back to our usual goal own go format in the coming weeks, but you know, this summer of sport is something you and I have and can go backwards and forwards with. So what was your first event of the summer that caught your eye?
Well, I'll take the one that was on at the same time as the World Cup, which obviously was Wimbledon. And you know, all of us, well, I think most of us have got a soft spot for Roger Federer. And as he's got older, we've always known that, you know, whilst he's the most aesthetically beautiful, talented, plays the game on a different level in terms of shot making and ball striking, he had a fragility when coming up against the monsters of Nadal and Djokovic. You know, so my Wimbledon went like this. I didn't tune in until the semi when he played Nadal, and I said, look, I know how this goes. He's going to win the first set, and you know, he'll lose in four. And you know, he did that magnificent performance, and my family, who are all Federer fans, they gave me a hard time for not believing. And he gets to the final, and same thing, loses the first set, I think, comes back, then yep. goes to dominate the game with just astonishing tennis to get to two match points on his serve. And you say, well, I got it wrong. And then again, and so what I'm saying, Grant, is it was so painful for me that I don't think tennis has got much more to give me. That for me, I think, was the zenith. You know, I don't see another Federer around. I don't think Federer will recover from that psychologically. And I'm not sure I'm going to tune in, because I just don't see what's in it for me. Is that strange?
Yeah. No, do you know what? I understand where you're coming from. I was thinking about this actually after watching that final, because I had the two on. I had one on the TV and one on my laptop, the cricket and the tennis at the same time. And I thought about it afterwards a lot, because I, like you, I'm a huge Federer fan, and it was crushing to see him lose that. I mean, it really was. And it's funny how someone you've never met, you can take it so hard when they lose a random tennis game. But thinking about it, you know, I've been very fortunate in my life to see just about every champion play live. You know, the Michael Jordan, Magic Johnson in basketball. I've seen all the great footballers play live of my era. You know, I saw George Best week in, week out at Fulham, even though he was at the tail end of his career. But I've seen the greats that I care about. I've seen them all live. And Federer is the only champion that I haven't seen play live. And I got really quite depressed, actually, thinking about it.
That's the word.
Like you, I thought, this is probably going to be the end for him. I hope I'm wrong. I would love to see him ram these words down my throat. But he probably won't win another Wimbledon again, because I think, like you, I believe that this will be psychologically so painful for him. And I got to thinking about it, and I got to thinking about all those greats that I've seen. And I have to say, Federer is the greatest champion I've ever seen. And I mean that not just his athletic performance, not just the titles he's won, not just the way he's dominated his sport, but the class with which he's done it, and the skill and the talent. I've never seen anyone who is the complete package like Federer. And I'll take anyone on at any sport, and I'll have the debate.
More than
all
Tiger?
That, which is
a big
sport,
Tiger man?
Because Tiger, as it turned out, didn't have the character that Federer has. You know, Tiger was a great champion on the golf course, and as it turned out, a pretty lousy human being off it.
Yeah.
And Federer has been a champion on the court, a class act off the court. You really struggle to hear anyone say a bad word about him. The other players love him. You know, there's always this argument, there's people chipping away at him about, oh, you get favorable draws, you and Nadal, et cetera, et cetera. They want the big three to play and blah, blah, blah. You know, I've seen occasional, but I've never seen anything really deep and involved with a lot of proof talking, any smack about Federer at all. And I just think he, for me, is the beacon of what true sports greatness should be all about. Not just the performance, but the character and the personality. You know, he holds his press conferences in five languages.
Yeah.
He's a remarkable athlete and a remarkable human being. And I really did get quite upset that I am not going to have seen him play live at his peak.
Yeah, I get that completely, Grant. You know, he does have one weakness, of course.
What's that?
Did you see the dress his wife was wearing in the centre court?
I did not.
Have a look back.
Well, I don't remember it anyway.
I mean, like, it's like Swiss. It's like Heidi. You know, he could do better than that. Let's put it that way.
He could do... So wait. Let me get this straight. Roger Federer's weakness is the dress his wife wore on a particular journey. You know what? If I'm an athlete and that turns out to be, I'll take that. But the thing you said there, Rog, which is interesting, and I think it's important. You said, you know, I don't know if we'll ever see another Federer. Across the net from him in the semi-final was a man who is one Grand Slam behind him and has been, again, another astonishing athlete, an astonishing representative for the game of tennis. You know, any other era, Djokovic or Nadal would have 30 Grand Slams, as would Federer.
Yeah.
You know, the fact that these three guys have come along at the same time and played the level of tennis that we've seen is, I mean, look, it's remarkable. And will tennis have these golden years again? Certainly not for a while, I don't think. You know, there is a great young set of tennis players coming through. But, you know, when people say, oh, we won't see another Federer, people who are Nadal fans will sit with you all day long and tell you that Nadal's the better player, the better champion. And look, to me, that's not an argument that you just dismiss out of hand. I totally understand why they say that. I mean, we've been incredibly fortunate to have these three champions play. And you know, soon they're all going to be gone. And it is going to be a really sad day. But for me, Federer is the pinnacle of what it means to be a great sportsman.
I agree with that. There was something that, apart from the jokes, that there was something very interesting that came out after Wimbledon, which was the kind of article about sports analytics that has now been applied to tennis, where it kind of explained that there's two or three companies out there that are able to analyse the opponents so deeply that it gives specifically these three players an advantage these days. And it talks about how Federer used them when he kind of made his comeback about a couple of years ago. And it just shows again how sport is kicking on with it, with the help of tech, with the help of AI, with the help of deep coaching and scouting to take the sport forward. But for me, I'd leave all of that aside. You know, I get the point about Nadal, he's stronger in the head and all of that. But aesthetically, you know, with that one-handed backhand and everything, don't think we'll see anybody like Federer again.
Well, look, I hope you're wrong. But, you know, I kind of, if it's going to happen, let's not have it happen for 10 years or so. Let's savour him for a while. And you know, if another great champion comes along, so be it. That'd be great. But I kind of, you know, when he's gone, I don't want him to be forgotten.
No chance of that.
No, I know. All right. Well, look, let's talk about what you, when we wrapped for the end of the first season, Roach, that your highlight, you suspected the summer was going to be the Women's World Cup. And I've got to say, you were absolutely right. What a fantastic tournament it was.
Yeah. I would also say we did think it was going to be a kind of like tipping point moment. And if you look at the attendances that are now coming to games in England between the club sides, these attendances are astonishing. Now, so I think there's no doubt that the women's game is here. What did I take away from it looking at it? Two things. I actually enjoyed the fact that they're not as athletic as the men, because it took me back anyway to the kind of like World Cup side scene in 70-74, where there's a lot more space in the middle of the field. The really talented players, you know, weren't fixated with pressing, and you know, they could put their foot in the ball, look around and pick a pass, and some of these girls can really do that. I liked a couple in the Dutch team especially, so that was a real positive for me. It was a little bit like, you know, it's football that's not just athletic, that sometimes you feel that's the way it is in the men's game. The second thing is not so positive, that all of this politicizing and using it as a vehicle to that really got my goat. It really got my goat, Grant. And I just want all this stuff to stop. You know, they don't need that. They're doing themselves a lot of harm by playing to this card. All is theirs to lose now. And, you know, some of these women, especially in the American team, they've got the wrong ideas and they need some good advice.
Well, it's an interesting one, because you know, I come down on the same side of you, but let me play devil's advocate.
Yeah.
Because, you know, when you go back to, I mean, these are groundbreaking athletes, right? These women doing what they do in a sport which is, as you said, the attendances are now through the roof after this World Cup, because it got such such coverage and had such a high profile. So, you know, these women are trailblazers for women's soccer. There's no doubt about it. And, you know, I go back to, again, we've mentioned him already this week, but Michael Jordan, when he was a trailblazer in the NBA, and he stayed out of politics studiously. Yeah. He avoided it like the plague. He never, ever commented on it. He avoided it. And, I mean, he caught so much flack for not getting that. For, you know, they're saying, look, you're a role model, you're a figure, you need to stand for someone, you need to speak out, you have a platform, blah blah blah. So, you know, I think these women are damned if they do and damned if they don't, just as Michael Jordan was. So I can totally understand why they would want to do it. But I think you know, speaking out about the gender gap or that kind of thing is fine. Making it about politics is not. You know, that's where I had a problem when it was, you know, never Trump or whatever this. And I'm not standing saying this is a pro-Trump comment before we get all that nonsense going on. But I think it, sport and politics is like church and state for me. They should be kept apart, and play the game, grow the game, but don't make it about politics, because I think you're absolutely right. By doing that, you alienate 50% of the population, and women's sport just isn't in a position to do that.
I just don't like some of their attitudes, you know, like it's not so much whether it's a...
The tie game you're going to talk about now, right?
I just think that, you know, a lot of the attitude is, it's not what I call elegantly humble, you know, and I think that's what they could be just now, and they could be wonderful, wonderful ambassadors. But they want to, like, you know, take it to people, and they want to, and you know, the dressing room afterwards, and they're all twerking, and you know, this will sound probably awful.
Yeah, the twerking thing was awful. I agree with you. I mean, if you're trying to help women advance, and then you go and do that, I mean, it doesn't really help your cause, does it?
Well, I don't think so. I know a lot of people, you know, gave me a hard time when I said that at the time, but I just don't think it's right. I also don't think it's what sponsors will be looking for, if that's what's in their head. But, you know, I would like to come back to the main point. I think, you know, technically a lot of these girls can really play. And secondly, I think, you know, they've got a differentiator from the men's game, which is there's more space. So you can see people that have got a real talent to change a game with one athletic gesture. And that's really good for me.
Yeah, look, it's a shame that the politics does come into it. But, you know, as I say, purely on a football level, I thought it was a great tournament. I thought, you know, the Americans deserved to win. I thought England were going to beat them, but they just couldn't pull it off, which is a shame personally. But I thought the Americans, they're a top-class football team. There's no two ways about it. But I was really surprised how much I enjoyed watching it. It wasn't something I'd look forward to particularly, but it was on, and it did get a lot of coverage, and I did find myself watching a fair bit of it. And I got to say, I enjoyed every single game I watched, which I can't say for the Men's World Cup at any point in the last 20 years.
Yeah, I think that's an advantage they've got. But, you know, before leaving the whole world of World Cups, you know, somewhere in an arena quite close to that was the FIFA Esports World Cup. I don't know whether you caught that one.
Ah, yes.
I mean, truly astonishing numbers. I mean, if you're not reading these tea leaves, then don't blame anybody when you find the rug has been pulled away from you. These kids are on a different wavelength, and we need to get our act together to try and find a way to at least operate in the world that they are in, and hopefully bring them a little bit towards us. But, you know, that event was astonishing, Grant.
Yeah, I did. To be honest, I don't remember the numbers, but I remember seeing the coverage and being, as you said, astonished is the right word. I mean, I knew how big the esports has been getting. I've seen the prize money numbers being thrown around, and the, you know, the overall attendance figures. But it was amazing. And you're absolutely right, Roger. That is the future. There's no two ways about it. And regardless of what people think, esports is going to be a huge competitor for every live sport on the planet. There is no two ways about that.
Yeah. So listen, let's tell me a little bit about Fulham, because we want to come back a little bit to our own teams. Tell me a little bit, you know, you went down, you've got your parachute payment, so you probably got a very competitive squad. What's your mindset after having been in the big league and now you're back down, and what it means to the way you're following your team?
Well, you know, I follow them the same way I've always followed them, but that's mainly because I've lived overseas from them for the last, you know, 30 odd years, right? So I've become used to following them when I can, because they, you know, they're not always on. I mean, I follow the games when they're on the Fulham app and yada yada yada. I don't listen to all of them, but it was interesting. I listened to the game against Millwall a couple of weeks ago. You know, Fulham won 4-0 and just destroyed Millwall. I think they had something like 80% possession. And you look at the stats, the number of passes Fulham put together versus Millwall, and the comments of the Millwall manager after saying, this team just plays on a different level. And I watched them against Nottingham Forest, same thing, but they ended up not getting the result. I watched them against West Brom yesterday dominate the first half, only get one goal in front, and then see themselves pegged back and only draw the game. And I kind of thought, as I watched them really just walk rings around these teams, that they're kind of in purgatory. You know, they're way too good for the Championship, and they're not good enough for the Premier League. And it just made me realise how important the signings are when you go up to the Premier. I think the mistake Fulham made was signing a whole bunch of players.
You said that.
We talked about this before. They've come down, they've signed some great players, Knockhart, Caballero, both great Premier League players with Brighton and Wolves. They've got a really good team. They've got a good young coach in Scott Parker who seems to be tactically solid, and he's built a cohesive unit, and they do seem to be playing for each other again. So it's been great to watch them, but I watch as they don't kill teams off that they're absolutely battering. And if you don't do that in the Premier League, it's over. So I'll watch them with interest, as I always do. I'll get far too emotional about it this year, as I always do. And I would absolutely expect them to be up there, either in the promotion spots or the playoff spots. I think anything less would be a disaster for them. But if they do end up getting promoted, I will assume they're coming straight back down again, unless they do something really sensible in the summer. It's a sad truth, but the gap between the Championship and the Premier League is enormous.
No, it is. But Norwich have kind of like gone against the trend there.
Well, look, we've seen this, Roger. There's always one team that comes up and does great. Huddersfield, remember, they were leading the league 3 or 4 years ago at the start of the season.
No, you're right. The polarisation is huge. You're right.
It's huge. But getting back to the Premier League and away from Fulham, it's great to see what Leicester are doing this year. You know, I know you won't be happy that their manager's doing well.
I know what you mean. We'll come on to Celtic still briefly in a second.
Yeah, I mean, look, the briefer the better for everybody, I think. But it's great to see Leicester, being up there and genuinely being in the mix and playing good football again, and if nothing else, proving it wasn't a one season thing and they're going to be perennial relegation battlers after that. I think again they've built a good team, they're playing well, they've got a good manager. I think the future's bright for Leicester again, which is fantastic.
Yeah, they've got some excellent players. Love that Belgian guy Tielemann. I think he's a super player.
Yeah.
But it's been interesting with football this year. I don't know whether you've seen it, this year's transfer window, how few of the big players have actually moved on.
Yeah,
very few. And I think, again, this is a little bit of the worm turning, where clubs are starting to say, look, it's just too much hassle. It's too much money. The risk reward is too high. The chance of you disrupting my dressing room is too high. So, Mr. Neymar, no thanks. Mr. Icardi, no, leave my club, please. And I think the numbers are now starting to get too big, Grant. And I think, we're going to see a rebalancing of a lot of the thinking around football about how many of the teams should be local players, etc., etc. I sense that, what Ajax did last year and what some of the German teams have done in recent years is going to become a trend that, people that are treating football clubs more and more as a business these days are starting to say, I can't justify that capex. Maybe he's going to give me extra 10%, but, there's a risk of minus 40 for all kinds of related costs, hidden and not hidden. So I'll just leave it, thanks. I think you're going to get that kind of thinking more and more.
But does that not mean the gap between the big spending, because there will always be big spending teams, that. And does that not mean that gap just becomes astronomical, or do you think that teams like Ajax, and will it remains to be seen whether that was a one-off thing, or these young teams can be built, and more importantly, given the time by fans and owners to build and solidify and really challenge for the honours?
Look, maybe we won't cover it on today's episode, but what's happening with football is not really going to, the status quo is really not sustainable. If you look at the TV monies, the top 20 clubs in Europe and the TV monies that they get, almost all the clubs are English Premier League. Huddersfield's getting significantly more money from the TV than Juventus. none of that's sustainable, Grant. You know, the Super League is a potential answer to that. And then you've got, you know, the head of Juventus, Agnelli, who's also the head of the ECA, who says, you know, we need to start thinking about playing more games at midday for the Asian audience. Yeah. There's a whole lot of the football world that is not up for that, you know? And we're living in this kind of like, you called it purgatory. I would say that's a good word. We're in this kind of like a limbo where we've not yet reached the Americanization of a Super League, but we've so distorted our traditional structures that people are starting to get a little bit fed up. And, you know, I mentioned the player side of it being part of that. Another part of it is, I think, a lot of the fans, you know, you can see them in the reaction to clubs like Man City. And, you know, I think as I said at the start of the show, the next 5 years are going to dictate so much of what we end up with for the next two decades. And I just don't see football being able to hold this delicate equilibrium in this limbo. I just don't think it's possible.
Well, it's interesting because I think that's a big reason for all these behind-the-scenes documentaries, right? I mean, that's the way you do this is to you take a team like Man City, for example, which a sort of grassroots football fan, their default position is to hate them because they've got all the money and they've got all the big star players and they win every week, and you kind of you just don't want to like them. That's just kind of instinctive to football fans, and you put out a behind-the-scenes documentary, which is great entertainment. And it humanizes them, and you kind of end up going, oh, just a good bunch of guys. And it's not that you love them, but you don't dislike them, and you kind of follow the players that you liked. And I think by doing that, you know, we saw the Leeds United documentary on Amazon, which is fantastic. They're doing it in rugby, they're doing it in American football. And I think that's one of the big reasons for all this content, which is connecting the fans with players, not of their own teams, but knowing that fans of you know, Man United will be watching this documentary anyway, and fans of Chelsea and Liverpool and Arsenal, because they're football fans and they'll watch it through gritted teeth. But you can't help but see these guys as humans, and look, for the most part, they're all likable guys. And I think that is a big solution to some of the problems you're talking about. Is I think we'll see more and more of these behind the scenes documentaries, and they will be made to make the players and the clubs and the teams and the managers appealing to a neutral audience. Because once you do that, you do end up not having to rely on the hardcore fans anymore. You've got casual fans all over the world who will put some money in the pocket of Man City if they like the strip, because they like the documentary, because they like Vincent Kompany and they want a Kompany shirt. So I think that synergy between content, and you've spoken about this at length, and the teams themselves is a hugely important apex for what's going to happen in the next 5 years. And I'm going to be fascinated to watch it develop.
Well, you know, I think I'll take the other end of that trade on this one, Grant. You know, I've got a much more cynical view on this. I think.
No way.
I think, first of all, you've got a rather price-insensitive buyer in people like Netflix, who are just throwing money all over the place. And I think, you know, demand like that creates supply. There is an element of marketing and all of that, yes, but I think a lot of it's about money. But more importantly, Grant, I want to throw this at you. We're in this world of the cliche of storytelling and building a narrative around a brand, around a franchise, around athletes. We've got, very soon, we've got heading the bill on boxing. We've got the rematch between KSI and Logan. That is top of the bill, that has been covered by the new broadcaster DAZN, where you've got serious, serious professional boxers underneath on the undercards to these amateurs, these celebrities, these influencers. And, you know, a year ago, whenever it was that the first match happened, I saw my kids, you know, 16 and 14, really go, you know, crazy about the lead up to this and the hype, and really, really crazy. And, you know, so I was talking to them. I said, well, you know, I saw the rematch is coming up, and they said, yeah, that's a dead meme. you know? And you know, like, and I said, what? They said, did you not see the press conference you just done at really Cringeville? You know, that's the language they use these days. You know, it's over. And I'm thinking, I'm not sure DAZN knows that, you know? But the point I'm making is this, easy come, easy go, you know? And stories, if you're relying on stories, there's always somebody with a newer, fresher, better story. So I'm very wary about all this, create the narrative, it'll all be great, we're all interested. You know, probably exactly the opposite of what you think my view would be on this is, but as I get older, I'm getting more and more drawn to, you know, what you saw with, you know, the Union Berlin fans. I don't know whether you caught that. So they get into the Bundesliga, the first division, for the first time in their history. And, you know, to celebrate that, the fans take pictures of the fans who've passed away at this point, who had been with the club forever, and in a kind of like Luther King-esque statement, didn't live to see the promised land.
Right, right.
And like, you know, I'll send it to you after. You see this video of these fans in there, you know, holding up the pictures, normally black and white pictures of blokes that have passed away. And, you know, that's not storytelling. That's not here today, gone tomorrow, over 12 months. That's solid, solid stuff. And, you know, I just think, I think we're going to rip this game apart. There's going to be the Hollywood clubs, the Hollywood athletes that are doing something over there and social media cliche and marketing and strategy. And over somewhere, there's clubs like Bury and Derby and Nottingham Forest and Entella and Celtic and Fulham that are going after something else. And, you know, as I say, I just think I see a lot of clubs right in the middle, neither fish nor fowl, and I'm not sure it's the right answer, mate.
Well, yeah, I don't disagree with that. I mean, I'm sure that was an incredibly powerful one. Please do send to me. But the other thing, I mean, on the same topic, there was a tweet that I was tagged in. I think you were as well, by a mutual friend and former guest, Colin O'Donnell.
Yes.
Who tagged us both in a video of the Hibs fans, which I hadn't seen, singing Sunshine on Leith after beating Rangers in the cup final. Now,
beautiful.
It's a 7-minute sing-along, basically one and a half songs. But that, to me, that 7 minutes just, I mean, every time I watch it, every time I think about it, it sends chills down my spine, because that is everything sport is about. That is a team who won the cup for the first time, what, 114 years, was it? I mean,
yeah.
It makes the curse of the Red Sox look like child's play. But to see that stadium where half the fans had gone home, it was empty. The Rangers End was completely empty. I understand why they went, right? I totally get why that half was empty. But the joy, the spontaneous outpouring of, I mean, true elation in amongst the Hibs fans. And the fact that nobody was leaving that stadium, right? They weren't going home. It wasn't going to happen. I mean, I went to, when I first moved to Australia in 2005, I went to watch the playoff game between Australia and Uruguay. And they were basically trying to get into the World Cup finals. It was a playoff. And I can't remember what the result was in Uruguay, but the second leg was in Sydney. And, you know, they needed a win. And the match went to penalties, and the Aussies won on penalties to get into the World Cup final. I think for the first time in their history, but I may be wrong about that. Maybe they got into one, you know, 20, 30 years ago. And I mean, the stadium was, I've never experienced anything like it upright. I mean, I've lost plenty of important penalty decisions as an England fan. I was there in the Euro 96 semi where we lost to Germany.
Many to choose from.
Deflated leaving a stadium. Yeah, exactly. But the same thing, the stadium, they were, you know, they were singing Men Down, Land Down Under. They were singing. They wouldn't go home. I mean, they came over the PA and said, look, can you all please go? Because the trains are waiting for you. Please leave the stadium. And no one was going anywhere. So to watch that Hibs video, I totally understood it. It was everything that was good about sport. And I just loved it. So I think when you're talking about this stuff, these real grassroots movements, I'm all for it. And I hope that Berlin-style grassroots fans campaign, A, takes hold and spreads more widely, and B, doesn't get compromised by social media and made into something fake and something, you know, staged, because that's what I fear will happen.
You're right. The Proclaimers, of course, with that song, that is one of the, the great, great songs that obviously Hibs, being the Leith club, have adopted, and they're fans of the club, and it's just wonderful. I just want to not lose the point here, which is, I think people are getting, in this battle to hold it all together, we're going to end up satisfying nobody. We're not going to satisfy Agnelli and Juventus and wanting to get all these new Asian fans. And we're going to do the wrong thing for clubs and supporters that have got a different idea. And you know, that like all of the things that this podcast is about and everything that we talk about, it's about finding the talented leaders to find that balance. And I'm hopeful. But, you know, I tell you what, you know, why do you think both English leagues can't find a chief executive these days? Why do you think that? Do you think that's coincidence?
Have you thrown your hat into the ring?
No. I think my days of doing that are over. But you know, the reason is that it's what I said. You know, the pressures, especially in the Premiership, ripping this apart from the top six and the remaining 14, are almost unmanageable. You know, this person will come in and they will try and find balance where there's no balance to be found. All it is a succession of horse trading and quid pro quos. And you know, I don't think a lot of people, a lot of really talented people, want to risk their career, let's say in their late 30s, early 40s, to be in the hands of, you know, club chairman that ultimately will dictate what they can and can't do. And that, you know, I think people in the industry will recognise what I'm saying here. What they should do, both organisations, they won't, is look at people that perhaps are at the tail end of their career and, you know, probably aren't that bothered and, you know, would take, you know, one final swing for the bleachers and go for it. But you know, the background is that you've got a sport that's struggling to find balance as the market rips it apart.
I'm reminded when you're talking about whether you threw your hat in the ring, back in the 1980s in the city when I worked in London, there was a guy called Bob Leeds, and he used to write and apply for every manager's job. Whenever any manager got sacked, he would write a letter and offer his services, and he had a whole folder full of letters, rejection letters, including one, I might add, from Barcelona after Terry Venables left, and Bob Leeds wrote a letter suggesting that he might be the ideal candidate for the job. And he just used to collect all these letters from clubs, and some of the rejections were fantastic. So maybe if anyone listening to the podcast wants a job as chief executive of one of the English football leagues, they should just drop them a line, see if you get a reply.
Goodest chance as any these days.
Yeah, right. Well, I think that means it's your turn, Rog. Someone else that...
Let's get on to the golf.
Yes, good. I was hoping you'd get to this.
Listen, you know, I just had a moment where, really bizarre, Grant, you know, I was watching, I think it was day two. Yeah, it was the day two. It was the cut. And, you know, I haven't...
Now, this was the British Open.
Yeah, the British Open. Sorry.
The Open Championship.
Yeah, I did say the Open. Yeah, I didn't say the American Open. The Open. And, you know, most of us haven't had the chance to watch, you know, from morning to afternoon it's on. And, you know, I had it that day. And, you know, after a couple of hours, I started to get pretty bored, you know. And I thought, this doesn't work. You know, it's not quick enough. We're not near enough the sharp end of the tournament. Okay, there was the thing with Rory and the cut at the end that maybe saved that day. But day three and even day four was poor. And, you know, we talked about this at the time. I said, look, this is a problem for golf. Slow play, you know, the inability to get the stars competing against each other at the right moment. And... I was watching the last day with my family, and I was just basically outvoted that it was so boring, and I couldn't hold the line. I don't think I even wanted to hold the line, because, you know, let me compare it with the Masters earlier in the year, the one that Tiger won. You know, my son's not a golfer, so, you know, we got into Sunday evening, the back nine, and you know, I was watching it, and he's, you know, he probably faked interest a little bit. He said, "What are you watching, Dad?" I said, "It's Amen Corner. It's Sunday afternoon. It's the Masters. This is what it's all about. Oh, and by the way, you've got Molinari, who is untouchable these days. He's in the lead, should win it. But Amen Corner is named for that for a specific reason." He really got into that story. Then sees Kiko put a couple in the water.
Yep.
And I said, "I told you. Why do you think it's called Amen Corner?" You know, and he said, "Well, that's amazing." And then, you know, you've got the whole story of Tiger, and that worked. You know, the procession of Shane Lowry and the whole 4 days, I thought, as a spectacle, as content, as something that younger audiences would get into, I thought it was a mile off, Grant. And golf's got a real issue.
Look, I as I said, you talked about this last season. I pushed back. I am understanding your point of view, and I'm moving closer towards you. I watched the Open. Now, for me, it was perfect because I was working, so I kind of had it on in the background, and it was perfect. And I thought the Rory charge made me stop what I was doing and concentrate on the golf. And I got to say, I thoroughly enjoyed Shane Lowry's victory. You know, I love the clips on social media of him celebrating afterwards in the pub.
Fields of Athenry. You know, very, very satisfying for me when, before the thing started, you'd had the drummer bands insisting that they did their little ditties before in Northern Ireland, and then to have a Celtic supporting Fields of Athenry singer with a claret jug. That absolutely is so sweet. Sorry, but I needed to say that.
Well, I know, I figured you would, but we'll put that aside. But I actually enjoyed the story of Shane Lowry. You know, he's a everyman, and to see an everyman win the Open is a fantastic thing, I think, for golfers. But what caught a lot of my attention was the golf course. You know, they haven't had an Open Championship since the 1950s when Max Faulkner won, 1951, I think it was. And so that course is completely unfamiliar. And so on the same way that Augusta is, everyone that is a golf fan and watches the Masters knows every blade of grass on that course from watching on the TV year after year, Royal County Down was a complete mystery to many people. And so I thought it was a beautiful golf course. I think it was a fantastic test of golf. And for me, the course was one of the stars of the show. But I thoroughly enjoyed it, Roger. I totally get where you're coming from in terms of the younger audience. And I understand that I'm not that anymore. And I'm a golfer, and so of course I'm going to enjoy it. To the casual sports fan, I think you're right. I think it has a problem. And interestingly enough, given what you'd said about this before, and I thought about it as I watched it, I saw on Twitter again a clip of Rocco Mediate, which I think I posted to you and sent it to you, talking about a new golf that they're pushing in America now, which is 12 holes. And it's, you know, if you haven't got 4 hours and you've only got a couple of hours, you can play six, or you can play 12, or you can play three lots of six, and it's 18 holes. And, you know, they're trying to make it shorter and jazzier. I'm not quite sure why they've got Rocco Mediate to be the face of it if they're trying to make it shorter and snazzier and cooler with the kids. But clearly you were right, and this is happening. This move, you know, Top Golf, the thing where you can have a few beers and play against the screen.
They're the guys.
That's happening, right? It is definitely happening. But, you know, there's a good chance that you, if you can grab a whole generation of golfers with this new short form glitzy golf, I think golf has a chance purely because of the amount of tradition and the amount of history in golf. And if you get hooked on golf, there are so many stories. In, you know, to your point about Tiger, and to your story about that Tiger of Amen Corner. You know, it was 1933 that Herbert Warren Wynne wrote the article about Amen Corner, and here we are almost 100 years later talking about it. Golf is rich in tradition. It's rich in history. It's rich in stories of compelling athletes. You know, the Ben Hogan story, they made a film about it, Follow the Sun, in 1951, 53, I think it was, 52, somewhere around there. But there are so many stories that if you get the next generation hooked on the game, once you're hooked on golf, it is so challenging and so difficult and so different every time you go out and play, that I think there is a chance that this new young generation will get hooked and fall in love with golf as it has been, with traditional golf, with 18 holes, with the stories. I hope so, because I think that you're right. There is a chance this next generation will be lost to the game.
Well, I take a much more pessimistic view than you.
Of course you do.
I think we're at 5 minutes to 12 on this one. And the problem with golf is the administrators are really, really old-fashioned. Oh, on that, Grant.
Yes, that's true.
Yeah, well, it's a problem. On that, and I'll give you an example that I need to ask you a favour on. I was gifted for my 20th anniversary golf lessons and new clubs, because since I've been in Italy, I haven't touched a club, and my wife did that, and I'm back into it and I'm loving it, and I've joined a club in Italy, but they need a handicap certificate, and I don't have one, and my old club in Scotland doesn't have the records and won't give me the records. I've spoke to the SGA, I've spoke to the RNA because I've got contacts there, and let's say they're relatively traditional. And this is the beauty of Italy, as you sit there in Umbria with your Prosecco. The club guy in Italy says to me, he says, look, you got a mate in the UK that's a member of a club? I said, yeah. He said, get him to ask a handicap certificate in his name, send it over to me and we'll tip X it out and put your name in it. That's Italy, mate.
Yeah.
So I need that. Can you get that for me?
I know a guy who can, Roger, of course.
Get him a handicap certificate, any club, get it to me, I'll get it to them, they'll do the necessary, and I'm up and running. That's important.
Join us next week for another edition of Fraud Live.
Listen, you're in Italy, you know what it's like now.
Wait.
Like, listen, you were watching Fulham yesterday on your little iFollow app. You had the wine out, and it was as good as it gets. Admit it. That's Italy.
I've got to say. I'll put it this way, Rog. I'm not going to deny it. How's that?
There you go. So, like, you know, people ask, well, why did you come out here? So, oh, they never come back. Well, it's like this. And if you're lateral thinking and you've got initiative, you can get round the myriad of rules that are in Italy by just being imaginative, and that's what we need to be.
Imaginative. Well, listen, the other, there is another part of golf we need to talk about, and it's a universally dark side. Well, there's two,
really?
Actually.
What's that?
One is slow play, and the other is Matt Kuchar.
Oh.
Now, I mean, come on, we have to bring this up. The slow play. Yeah, we do, because I want to get you going on this, because the slow play is a problem. Yeah, if you're right about this, if you're right about the way golf is going, and you're right about the audience changing, you're right about possibly losing the next generation.
For sure.
The thing that will kill it is slow play.
Yeah.
And there have been a couple of examples. I've seen one of the men, which is Bryson DeChambeau, and one of the women's.
By the way, what a great name.
And one of the women's tour. I forget who it was. I just saw the clip once.
The whole Solheim Cup has been very slow, isn't it?
Well, the Solheim Cup is another example. But there was I think it may have been either an amateur tournament on the women's side. But they showed, you know, this girl doing her routine for making a putt. I mean, it was ludicrous. It was absolutely ludicrous. And watching DeChambeau do the same thing on the men's tour, watching Justin Thomas's reaction to it. I mean, it's infuriating to watch it, what it must be like if you're a competitor playing in the same group as him. Now, why the authorities don't stamp down on this hard, I have absolutely no idea. Because I'm not going to say it's killing the game. That's way too much hyperbole. But it's such an easy thing to stop happening. I mean, it really is an easy thing to stop happening. Don't penalise them money. Dock them a shot. I guarantee you.
Yeah.
They get one shot, they'll change their attitude. I mean, it's remarkable. I don't understand
why this is such
a problem.
It's the same in anything like strict liability against racism in football. You just need balls as the administrator. You know, it comes down to having the cojones. It's as simple as that. Because, you know, if you do that, or if you dock points from a club that's got racist chanting, they're your stakeholders. They're often your shareholders. And, you know, you're going to put your job at risk. You know, and it comes down to leadership and how brave.
But look, football is it's it's different, right?
Is
but
it?
In golf, you... Well, let me explain what I mean by that.
Okay.
In golf, you're the governing body. You are running the business for the fans. You are running the business for the players who are members of the PGA of America, right?
Yeah.
There is not one single person, except for the three or four people who are slow, who isn't on your side. You haven't got to win over the fans. They hate it. You don't have to win over the rest of the players. They hate it. You don't have to win over the sponsors. They hate it. Why the hell are you not just doing something about it? Because you have buy-in from everybody.
Grant,
what's the problem?
But I'll tell you what the problem is, Grant. It's just something that you haven't experienced in life, which is you've gone into a sports organization and see what the administrators are like. You know, when they say the culture of the bowling club, so many sports have had that. These are glorified secretaries picking up, you know, subscription money for the tea bags when you go in the room. And, you know, the problem is they haven't moved on with the times. You know, they will quote the rule book at you all day long with gusto if they think that you've done something wrong or you're behaving without the etiquette. But you take that argument that you've just had there, that's well above their pay grade. They just don't get, and you could talk, it's SFA, it's you know, whatever organization. That's why, you know, when I see the guys running cricket, I always give them, you know, the big up, because I know the difference that it makes. Adam Silver again at the NBA, you know, he's talking this week about, you know, the stadiums are really broadcast studios now. You know, like, whether you agree with that or not, they're moving with the times, they're seeing the challenges, and they've got something to try and come up with. So many of the sports administrators are on five-star expense accounts, too much hassle, and don't get me into any controversy. That's why somebody like Top Golf is going to wipe the floor with this sport. Absolutely wipe the floor.
Well, that reminds me of saying, we'll shelve that for now, Rog.
Yeah.
And look, you know, look, let's talk. We're an hour into this already, you and I, and I know we could go on for a lot longer, but let's talk a little bit about what the listeners can expect coming up in the second series, because not only do we have some fantastic guests lined up, and hopefully some returning to season two that the audience loved from season one, but we've also got some other news.
Yeah, we've got a sponsor, Smart Sports, which, you know, very much along the lines of what I was saying a second ago, is thinking about disrupting sport and taking sport into rendered worlds. We had Chris Cairns on at the end of last season, the founder. He's absolutely disrupting what he thinks will happen with sport and taking it into where these young kids live, which is in the world of Fortnite and the Unreal Engine and some of the things we mentioned earlier. Equally, his solution is going to solve a lot of the problems of empty stadia and the logistics and everything like that. So he's going to sponsor this podcast in season two, but he didn't want to do it, and that's classic Chris, didn't want to do it in the old, you know, brought to you by way. You know, he wants to bring us a question every week that you and I and the guest of that week will discuss. Which is great. It's proper content sponsorship, yep. Proper content marketing. And his question for the first week is, you know, we saw Simon Jordan talking about the Premiership going for, you know, the OTT-owned content platform. Don't sell their rights to the various pay TV people and going down the classic direct-to-consumer route. Simon Jordan thinks the Premiership could make a lot more money out of that. And he's asking us whether we think that's true, and if not, why not? So off you go, mate. Tell me what you think about that.
Well, no, this is absolutely right. I mean, Chris obviously nails it, because this is the focal point of everything we've been talking about. I mean, we've just talked for an hour about this, and what is happening in the Premier League, this is what it all comes down to, right? Is this all about making money? Is this an exercise in, okay, what's the next thing we can do that will make us more money? Or is this an exercise in trying to engage the fans, as we've talked about with Berlin, and what's best for the fans? And we all know that this is a very interesting situation, because the clubs are going to do whatever's in their interest to make the most money, because most of them are now businesses.
Yeah.
Now, they're very, very fortunate in the fact that they have probably unwilling, but they have a buy-in from the fans, because if that's the route they go, if that's how fans need to get their football, they're going to get it. And of course they can go direct to fans, because the fans want the content, and if you only give them one choice, take it or leave it, they are going to, you know, they'll stop going out for dinner twice a week with the wife so they can afford the access to their team's games. So yeah, I think they can definitely go straight to the fans. The question is, if they go straight to the fans and it's an exercise in wringing out every last cent that they can from that direct contact with them, then they're going to run into problems. Not straight away, but there will be a tipping point where the fans can no longer afford to do it. And the question is, how far away is that? And I suspect, given everything else that's going on in the world, it's probably not that far away, or certainly not as far away as the Premier League thinks it is. If they'd done this 5 or 6 years ago, they'd have had a much longer runway.
I don't disagree with any of that. Here's my view, and of course, this is probably the thing I'm most known for in my whole career in football, which was SPL television, which was this idea back in 2002. I absolutely believe that if you want to market a sport, the way to do it is to know your fan base, your customer, in deep, deep detail, and market them in a personalised way. So in terms of doing that, it's better to be in charge of the content rather than licensing it to somebody else. Secondly, if you're following English sport and certainly Scottish football these days, you're probably having to have three different subscription packages: Sky, BT Sport and Premier Sport. Are the ones in Scotland. That's not going to fly anymore. There's a whole process of rebundling going on now, and you know, you can see what Disney's doing in that area. Thirdly, there's the issue of relegation. Now, so what you're doing if you create something like this is you're creating equity value. You know, you're creating what Simon called the Netflix of sport. What DAZN is pitching itself as. So, you know, you get involved in that, you're 20 clubs, you get relegated, you go down. What happens to your equity grant? You know, it gets pretty complex that, you know, you know, most people don't think about that, but relegation, as always in European football, is much, much different to anybody else. I think this will come, but I believe the smart way to do it is that some of the things that you talked about, and, you know, I'm probably going to steal a little bit of what Gary Neville was talking about, you know, I don't agree with Simon's numbers that says, you know, it's a multiple of the revenues they get in today. I think that's wildly optimistic.
Well, no, but it could be. The question is, for how long will it sustain?
Yeah, but
that?
That's the question. Yeah. But what they should do if they do go down that route is they should use that uplift in rights values, if there is one, and I've got a bigger question mark than you on that, if there is one, and I would insist that it's top sliced a lot of that revenue to subsidise ticket prices at grounds.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that at all.
You know, that would give them a PR win. It would give them a win on a whole lot of different areas, and but you know, it's coming. You know, and to come back to Chris's question, a rights holder needs to get in charge of their marketing, get in charge of their own storytelling. It doesn't make any sense if you think that your sport is a brand, is a story, that you license that whole process to somebody else. So, you know, that was my view 15, 17 years ago. It's even more my view now that the tech makes it so easy, and the data, rich data, makes it so easy. So I think it's going to come. I think a lot of sports, certainly the non-premium ones, second, third tier, fourth tier, they won't have any choice, because the pay TV guys are throwing so much money to hold on to the big sports, Formula One, the Premiership, all of these ones, that they're just saying to second and third tier, bye-bye, you know, you're on your own now. So there's a real wake-up, cold shower moment coming, and even if they didn't want to do it, so many sports are going to have to get their head around this direct-to-consumer business.
So what does that mean for the smaller sports, Rog? Because, you know, the cost of doing this has come down, but do these smaller sports sustain this? Are we going to go to a place where, you know, you struggle to see minority sports getting a foothold simply because nobody shows them except the clubs and the leagues themselves?
Well, that comes back to the point I said earlier about then what's your exposure strategy, your free-to-air strategy. The really, really smart ones, and you know this, Grant, because you guys at Real Vision are all over this in a different vertical, in the financial vertical, but it's the same thing. You know, you've got a niche a fan base, customer base that are very willing to pay for your product, and sometimes they're willing to pay a lot and be very much part of a community, and you can have a whole ARPU strategy around that. But to grow that audience, not just maximize the ones you currently have, you need to have an exposure strategy, which is going to involve social media. You know, Peter Hutton at Facebook is always on this, and I completely agree with him. And it's going to involve terrestrial TV, and it's going to involve the kind of things that Chris is talking about, which is bringing sport into the rendered worlds that the kids recognize. So I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing. Yeah, it's going to be cold turkey because sports have got lazy. You know, they always got the renewal from Sky or BT, and they didn't really know what they were doing with that money. And the story of sport in the last 20 years has really been one about, with a few exceptions, laziness. And that period is coming to an end at a rate of knots, mate. And, you know, to use a phrase, you better skill up really quickly on data and direct to consumer marketing.
Yeah, no, look, it's it is changing so fast. I mean, you have been way ahead of this, and you know, you've taken me along for the ride. This was stuff that I understand now that I haven't given nearly enough thought to over the last few years, but I'm catching up fast, and I think you're absolutely right.
Well, so thanks, Chris, for that, and thanks for the sponsorship. And, you know, the questions of that caliber are going to add to what we hopefully can contribute to the readers. And, you know, as you say, what's coming up? You know, our next guest is going to be the amazing Mark Oliver from Oliver and Oberm, the kind of like doyen of cerebral sport. He works on all kinds of strategy for rights holders and for private equity companies and broadcasters to work out the value of rights and how to package them. And, you know, I had the fortune to work with them back in the days of Scottish football. And I must admit, you know, my brain is still hurting from having to have conversations with Mark and keep up with the speed of his brain and the intellect. So he's going to come on and he's going to talk about all the things he's doing just now that's affecting so many sports. You know, we've seen private equity come to rugby and all of that. It's going to be a fantastic guest. Then we're going to have, you know, discussions around the changing world of sports content. We've seen The Athletic arrive into British sports journalism, I think, in a very, very positive way. You know, we're going to see talk about, you know, what's happening in the world of betting and sport. You've seen Ladbrokes kind of like pull back a little bit, certainly from Scotland, and say, you know, this isn't working for us. And then, I don't know, this is probably very industry, and a lot of people maybe didn't pick up on it, but, you know, the data rights from the Premiership and all Scottish football, all British football, is held by a company called Dataco that have done an exclusive deal with one of the big players called Genius, who are taking a much more aggressive line with non-official data collecting, and that resulted in one of the poor souls watching their team at Hull be ejected from the stadium because they thought they were sending data back to some of the competitors of Genius. So that's going to be a big theme going forward. So much that we're going to talk about, so many different sports. I'm really excited about it, and coming right back to the very start of the show, that's why, you know, we decided to go ahead. You know, Chris was a big help to do that. Giles Morgan, who was part of season one, he absolutely believes that the whole sponsorship market is going to change dramatically, and he, you know, felt that we had a great vehicle to allow us to talk about that and so many other things, and he'll join us. And, you know, there's just so much to talk about, Grant, and this isn't the moment to retreat to the sidelines.
No, look, you're absolutely right. This is, as we said in the introduction, you know, it's time to shake it off and get on the pitch, Rog, because there is a lot happening, and, you know, this is an avenue for people to make their opinions heard. And you know, you and I were staggered, I think, at some of the people in the industry that listen to this and listen every week, and you know, this podcast has become a direct line to the people we're talking about. And so as a fan, I would urge people to join the conversation and make their opinions heard. So, you know, to do that, you just have to follow us on Twitter. You'll find us at EntertainedR. You can contact us there. There's a lot of people that get involved in discussion every week, and we'd love you to do that. If you want to follow me, you can do that at TTMYGH.
And if you want to follow me, it's RPM Como, as in the lake, not Cornwall. Como, as in the lake.
As in the lake. Well, look, that's all for us for the first episode of Season 2. We'll see you next week. In the meantime, Rog, behave yourself. Don't get any controversies. I need you with a live mic next week.
I need that certificate.
All right, I'll
you know
on
you
it.
Can do it. And stay off the Prosecco down there. How many are you in already on this podcast? What, 3, 4?
I have nothing to add.
Take care, my friend. Enjoy Italy.
Cheers, mate.
Bye. Bye.